This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. trade deficit hit a record high last year. That comes from a new report by the U.S. Commerce Department. According to the report, the gap in the value of goods we imported from the world compared to what we exported jumped to nearly $900 billion. That's up more than 10% from 2017. That marks the widest the gap has been in history. It's not welcome news for President Trump, who uses the trade deficit as a key indicator of the U.S. economy over objections from many economists. The new figures also come as the U.S. and China continue to try to hash out differences in their trade negotiations. Mark Koplovich is an expert in international trade and an associate professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Let's put this record high in perspective. I know we adjust various things for inflation or not. Is this really a record high trade deficit, as the headlines are telling us?
Nominal numbers get bigger over time as the U.S. economy grows. So it's a large trade deficit. It's the largest trade deficit in the last decade. But I think that's a little bit of why people are excited about it in the news. If you go back a decade, we were in the midst of the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. The trade deficit had closed substantially.
Because we couldn't afford to buy stuff.
Mostly because businesses and consumers were not spending money and buying imports. So I do think you need to put it into perspective that the trade deficit is big, but the trade deficit for the U.S. is the largest economy in the international system for lots of reasons. Was always going to be big, right? So it's sort of a return in some ways to a normal.
And this is a kind of a weird situation for President Trump. He's been saying the trade deficit is bad. It's gone up now over the last couple of years, not necessarily because of anything he's done, though. And economists would probably give him a pass for this because a lot of economists don't necessarily think a trade deficit is that bad. Sort that out for us.
Yeah. So when you think about the national accounts of a country, right, you actually have two sides of the ledger, right? So when we say the U.S. has a large trade deficit, that's on what's known as the current account side. And basically, as you said, that means we are buying more from the rest of the world than we're selling. In order to do that, you have to finance that, right? And so the other side of the ledger is the capital account, which is basically loans and investment from the rest of the world. So at the same time that the U.S. has the largest trade deficit it's ever had, we have the largest capital account surplus that we've ever had, which is an inflow of money into the U.S. economy. So Trump looks at the trade deficit and says we're losing. You could look at the other side of the ledger and say, it's great, there's so many people that want to invest in the U.S. And what we've seen in the last year now is a lot of the other policies that are in place, right, are actually structurally going to ensure that the U.S. has a trade deficit and a capital account surplus.
One of those is the strong dollar. The dollar's looking pretty good compared to other currencies. As I vaguely understand it, that makes it easier for us to buy stuff and harder for other people to buy our stuff?
Yes. So when the dollar appreciates, that means our purchasing power for imports increases, but it makes our exports more expensive. And if you think about why the dollar has appreciated now about 20% in the last year, the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates 7 times, from 0 to 2.5% in the last 2 years now. When the U.S. interest rate goes up, more people want to hold dollars. Right. And that means that there's an inflow of money into the economy, and that pushes up the value of the dollar. So as that capital account surplus gets bigger, because people want to invest in the U.S., the trade deficit moves in the other direction.
Talking to political scientist Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison, looking at the trade deficit, it's a big number. Is it a bad number? Maybe not. But President Trump, and I think over the years union leaders too, have said it is bad because that means there are factories in China and elsewhere. They are employing people to sell stuff to us, and that's and we're not doing the same. So if you're interested in manufacturing jobs in particular, then yeah, we are kind of losing here. Is there something to that?
Well, you know, we've spoken about before, trade has these distributional consequences. So consumers benefit from international trade. Right? There's more goods, prices are lower, we're importing things and consuming them and buying them in Target and on Amazon. American export firms, so some sectors of the U.S. economy, manufacturing and services, are actually doing very well from trade. It's the concentrated distributional losers from trade who are in import competing sectors. So you have the steel sector, you have the auto sector, you have textiles, et cetera. And they're competing against foreign firms from China and elsewhere. So they're hurt by trade, right? But as consumers, everybody's a winner. things have gotten complicated now in the 21st century in that most firms that are exporters also import inputs into production. So with global value chains, it's a lot more complicated to now to say this factory or this firm in this sector is only an importer or an exporter.
We'll get into this a little more in just a bit, but what is the impact of the tariffs President Trump has put on some foreign goods and the retaliatory tariffs that other companies have done on this number that was our starting point, this last year's trade gap?
It's not insignificant, but it's not nearly one of the sort of two or three largest factors, right? So the macroeconomic, we had a massive tax cut, which was a big fiscal stimulus to the U.S. economy.
That gives us more money, or businesses
need more
money to
import. The U.S.
economy
is growing faster. Firms and consumers have more money. We're going to import more. The U.S. economy is growing faster than most of the other industrialized economies. So you add those things in, plus the increase in U.S. interest rates. And there's a lot of these monetary and financial and macroeconomic factors, which are much more important for the overall trade balance, not necessarily for specific sectors like soybeans or steel, but for the overall national trade balance.
We're talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison about new trade deficit numbers that show that trade deficit has gotten bigger, record numbers, depending on how you look at it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the trade deficit, the gap between what we sell to other countries, what they sell to us? What do you think about the fact that it's gotten bigger? Do you work for a company that sells products to other countries or import stuff to sell or work with here? Call and tell us what you think about how President Trump is doing on trade. Join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Stick around. More to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Mark Koplovich of UW-Madison, looking at America's growing trade deficit, new numbers out for last year's total. Want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think of how President Trump is doing on these trade issues? Do you support his negotiating tactics, tariffs, permanent or temporary? Do you worry about the administration starting a trade war? And do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. Also, if you're in a business or a farmer who's feeling the impact of some of these back-and-forth tariffs, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to our callers now. John is with us in Janesville. John, hello.
How are you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, John?
I was wondering where they're getting this information that we've got more money to spend now, because my house taxes went up a couple thousand this year, and I just had my income tax done, and I have never in 40-some years paid anything. I've always put in too much, and this year it's a $2,000 difference from last year, and my tax person goes, "You made the same amount that you made last year. You gave the same amount to charity and stuff as last year."
John, thanks a lot for that call. Now, a lot of people are seeing this, and it's a little more complicated, Mark, and I don't know John's particular situation, but as I understand it, many people may have ultimately paid less in taxes under those tax cuts, but more the way the deductions work, they might be paying the IRS instead of getting a refund.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think what the caller brought up is this disconnect between the micro level, what individuals are seeing, and then when we think about the trade deficit at the national, at the macro level. So the tax cuts went overwhelmingly to businesses and the upper tranches of the income brackets. So it's entirely possible that that John's taxes went up and other people's taxes went down. If you think about it at the macro level, though, there was, you know, tax cuts means the government is taking in less revenue, and that means there's more money in the hands of businesses and consumers. So when we aggregate back up to that national level, you see that as a big fiscal stimulus to the economy, an increase in demand. And again, that's showing up in spending more on imports than on exports.
Thanks for the call, John. I want to get into the current state of affairs when it comes to trade negotiations. A lot of attention, of course, to U.S. and China. And I think there are a lot of people out there who say, okay, we don't maybe like these, including members of Congress, we don't like these tariffs on our allies, Canada, Mexico, the European Union. China is just a different story, is it?
Yeah, it is in many ways. So, you know, we trade different things with China. because, you know, our closest allies are also advanced industrialized countries. So what we trade with Canada and the EU and Japan, it's different than what we're trading. We're specializing in services and certain types of manufacturing. China is specializing more in kind of low-skilled and heavy manufacturing. So the trade patterns are different. But a lot of the trade deal negotiations and the complaints about China are that they're breaking the rules of the international trading system. And, you know, so putting up tariffs is kind of a Band-Aid on that solution. Right. So the Trump administration and Robert Lighthizer, his key trade negotiator in particular, are pretty strongly opposed to the WTO and multilateral trade agreements in courts, which is traditionally how disputes, you know, you bring a case against China, you sue them, there's legal proceedings, maybe they change their policies down the line. Putting up tariffs is sort of a Band-Aid on this bigger, you know, factor that for structural reasons in the global economy, China right now is running a trade surplus and we're running a trade deficit. And steel tariffs and soybean tariffs aren't going to change that much on the margin.
And people have talked about the way the Chinese economy works is fundamentally different than ours. We have some government intervention in the economy. There are subsidies, there are crop supports, for example, things like that.
Yeah.
There's a very blurry line in many cases, it sounds like, between a business in China and a government entity in China, and that it kind of works differently.
Right. Absolutely. And there are clear, you know, China has not lived up to all of its World Trade Organization obligations. There are cases of violations of intellectual property and illegal subsidies and things like that. But if you took all of those things away, for largely macroeconomic reasons having to do with economic growth and development and money and finance, we still would run a trade deficit with China, right? And as we were talking about the national accounts, that's largely because we have a capital account surplus, right? China has a capital account deficit and a current account surplus, and we have vice versa. And structurally, where China and the U.S. are in the global economy, that's why that's happening, right? And so the tariffs and getting them to change their trade policies and subsidies probably isn't going to change a whole lot of that.
I want to bring this home a little bit to something we've talked about before. You mentioned earlier the distributional effects of changing trade conditions. It means it hits some people and it hits some areas harder than others. Some people benefit, some people lose. Are there ways for Rust Belt cities, I think this is a lot of what we talk about, where factories have closed down in part because of competition with a place like China. Are there ways to, for the United States, to repair some of that harm that's been done? Maybe they can't make those factories reopen, but something else. I don't know what.
There are. I mean, there's, you know, trade adjustment assistance programs to re-educate people, move them into different sectors, get retrained, that have been very poorly funded in the past. I mean, most of the solutions involve more revenue and more government investment and probably higher taxes. And so that's, you know, again, we get into distributional consequences and trade-offs of who is going to fund that and whether that's politically feasible or not.
And I've seen suggestions that people who are supporting these trade agreements and in some cases negotiating them said, yeah, part one, we get these negotiations in place. Part two, we provide solutions, we provide support for people who are going to be hurt by it, and then part one happened, and part two didn't.
And that's the decades-long politics of trade agreements is it is very hard to build political support and durable political support for those types of redistribution programs, because then you get into thorny domestic political debates of why are my tax dollars going to that program that's not going to benefit me, or, you know, my taxes are going to go up. And so the trade issues get entwined with a lot of other political economy and political issues about distribution in the United States, the welfare state, education, those sorts of things.
We'll leave it there for now. Mark, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Mark Koplovich, Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the U.S. trade deficit and the Trump administration's ongoing trade talks with China. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a Wisconsin couple who have been collecting antique phones for nearly 50 years and even supplying Hollywood movies with tough-to-find props. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Think back to the last time you were watching a movie or TV show set in the past, and one of the characters made a phone call. Well, it's quite possible the phone they were using came from Wisconsin. That's because Galesville, Wisconsin is home to what's most likely the world's largest collection of antique phones, something that got the attention of Hollywood producers as it grew over the last 50 years. Now, its owners are looking to get out of the collecting business and find a new home for their probably hundreds of thousands of phones. Ron Knappen is the co-owner of Phone Co. Inc. in Galesville, along with his wife, Mary. Ron, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, You're welcome.
How did you first get started, you and Mary get started collecting phones?
Well, basically, and the roots go way back to where I was quite an accumulator of antiques, and that goes back to when I was about 8 or 9 years old, hauling stuff in home from the dump. But starting in phones was actually while I was still teaching school, and I was moonlighting by being an actual true picker for other dealers, and I had a friend that would refinish old wooden wall phones very nicely, and he'd sell them to me for $25 a piece, and then I would sell them for $30. And I went to see him one time when we were down in near Galesburg, Illinois, where he lived, and I ended up buying all the collectible phones I had the money for, and had spent all our savings, which Mary thinks was around $400. Seemed like to me it was around $250. And we hauled those phones home. I was a little nervous about wanting to get my money back. She was, too, because we had little kids and the bank payments for a house. And so an old house we had fixed up in Melrose, Wisconsin. And so I sent an ad off to the Antique Trader Weekly. Came out on January, I think it was the 6th, 1972. And I realized a lot of result from that ad. I was dumbfounded. I was on the phone an hour every night for a week, and I knew where there were a lot of old phones. They had just been taking them out of the houses, and some of them were being destroyed. And there was a fellow in Wittenberg, Wisconsin, Ray Peterson, ran the phone company. He had a lot of interesting stuff. He had the mouthpieces that screw into these old phones that's a funnel shape. He had them different colors, like red and green and porcelain and clear glass. And I bought all that stuff as much as I could financially and put in an old station wagon. And then the collectors started repeating purchasing from us, and that's pretty much kind of a general survey of how we were starting in on the business. After about a year of that, it got a little bit more than what I could handle part-time, so I made a choice to either quit that or quit teaching, and my natural instinct is wheeling and dealing and being an adventuresome person into the past. That surveys it right there. Adventure into the past, and I enjoy it very much. I really enjoyed going into attics of old houses and buying stuff in old stores and things like that years ago.
And Ron, I bet you got a crash course in phone history, right? You've learned a lot about how phones have changed over time.
Well, I've done 7 books. The last book I put together on this was 2,200 pages. It was the 7th book I put together on telephone history. Yeah, I enjoy sharing this with other people.
Yeah. What's the oldest phone you've had in your possession at some point?
Well, I'm sure there is one out there that would have been dated around 1878 or 1880, but it's hard to tell because they didn't date them, of course. And there are peculiarities to these things that you can help identify them. But by and large, I think 1892 is, we still have a number of those hanging around, either a couple wall phones, the 1892 version, and it could have been made in 1895. They stayed the same for a while.
If I looked at one of these, would I know it was a phone? I mean, did it look like something we'd recognize as a phone today?
Oh, yes, yes. They've got a place to talk, and they've got a place, the thing to listen over, so that nails it down right there.
We're talking to Ron Knappen. He's a collector of antique phones from Galesville, co-founder of Phone Co. Inc., which he manages with his wife, Mary. And you, I understand you and your team now have, you don't just get these phones and sell them. You, in many cases, refurbish them, get them as close to working condition as you can. Is that right?
Well, that lately here, we've been straying away from that because the overhead is so high in running a business like this, so it's so labor intensive, that we've avoided a few of those steps because a lot of people just want to hang them on the wall. They don't care if they work or not because they're using cell phones anyway.
Who's collecting these phones? What kind of people are out there getting these? Is it, I'm a collector, I've got like 50 phones, or is it, I want that one phone I had when I was a kid?
You got them both. It's a variety. But collectors have seemed like they've been diminished, not as many people coming in to that arena now where they like to have one of each different type. That's been dropping off, and it's kind of sad. It's a gloom and doom thing. And there aren't many young people. It's the same way with polka dancing. You see fewer and fewer people, young people, doing it. But then now there may be a kind of a new start on some of this stuff where there's just a few people. You'll see them in the antique malls, young people now and then, more lately than you did maybe about 5 years ago. It just depends. There's certain people that want to collect one of each type, and for some reason there's an antique telephone in their memory, and they end up having actually a small collection, or they just want one phone to remind them of their childhood when they used a Prince's phone or something like that.
Now, you get calls, you've gotten calls over the years from Hollywood, you and Mary, to provide phones, right, for settings, for historical movies. What kind of things have you helped them out with?
Mary, could you answer this question about the movies? What kind of phones did you help them out with? I'm going to ask Mary. Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, we can put Mary on.
You want to get on, do you? Yeah.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. There's a variety of phones. We're just now sending a 500 set, which is a basic phone from the 70s, rotary phone, to Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is, I think,
a big TV show, yeah.
TV show, yeah. And so we send periodically to them. And then a lot of the movies will require, like, your office phones, your call directors, and your multi-line phones. So we said, and I can't name off the movies because I don't have time to go to movies and watch TV. So, but I always remember some of the first ones we sent phones to, and it was like Eight Men Out and Fried Green Tomatoes.
Oh.
Some of those old ones, I can remember those.
Now, have you ever watched one of those movies and watched for your phones showing up?
No, but whenever you see a movie and you do see those phones, we say, well, we got that, or maybe we sold them that, or,
And Ron mentioned earlier, starting with a station wagon, that station wagon got a trailer later. Now what, you've got a warehouse full of phones?
Yeah, we have several buildings full with phones.
Oh, more than one building.
Semi-trailers in our backyard. But, people are still picking up phones and needing parts, like for their wood wall phones, so they're ordering a lot of parts. We have people come to our shop that need parts, and they're digging them out of their attic, like, oh, I know, I've got that phone somewhere. So they go dig it out, and they find out that the crank is missing or the mouthpiece is missing or something. So they're ordering parts like that. So, and then there's people who are sending us phones to fix up, whether they're Bakelites or plastics or what have you there. They're sending up to a candlestick.
Yeah. And Mary, I have one more question. You can handle this one, or you can hand it off to Ron if you want. I understand you and Ron are looking to get out of the phone business now.
Yeah,
are you hoping somebody?
I think we should.
Okay. Are you hoping somebody picks up the tradition of being the phone person from Wisconsin?
Well, that would be a dream. Yeah. and we help them out a lot. Okay, Ron's waving his hand. He wants
to
talk here.
Thanks, Mary.
You mentioned the inventory.
Yeah.
It is quite fast. There's 29 semi-trailers in our backyard full of old telephones. They're jammed underneath them. They're in the pine tree out here in a pine row. There's actually five properties that we own in the area, and four of them are have quite a few phones in them. I would say you had semi-trailers, you wanted to haul them away, you'd take about 64 of them. I'd take them out of the 29 that are in the backyard here and six more on another property. So it's actually cumbersome, difficult to manage, and if we walk away from it, we still have an overhead, which is difficult to keep up with on Social Security.
Mm. And, Ron, do you have a couple favorite phones, you know, that are in your house that you just you love and you have them up on display?
Well, mostly there's two Ericsson wall phones that are 1892 versions out in the barn that I'd like to complete, that I think those deserve a tremendous amount of regard. I turned down one of those one time. I think she ended up getting $1,600 for it. I didn't feel I could afford it, and I kept these around thinking I'd fix them up. Never. In the house here, there's one walnut reproduction that I saved back because the grain was so pretty. Now, that's about it. I think an Eiffel Tower phone deserves preserving here, especially them that are pretty ornately decorated. Yep.
Well, I guess I better ask, what are you talking to me on right now?
I'm talking to you on a user-friendly, just a regular, Panasonic. Yeah, they never made phones very well for a while, but now they're pretty good quality. They'll last a while.
Ron, thanks a lot. Tell Mary thanks for me, and good luck as you're trying to sell off your collection.
I thank you for calling, and I wish you well. Goodbye.
Ron and Mary Knappen are the owners of Phone Co. Inc. in Galesville. They talked with us about their huge multi-decade collection of antique phones, which they're now looking to pass on to the right owner or owners.